Hi, folks. Thanks for listening to Only a Game. The show will start in just a moment, but first, I need to ask for your help. We'd like to better understand who is listening and how you are using podcasts. Please give us a hand by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. That's all one word, podcast survey. It takes less than 10 minutes and it really helps to support the show. That's npr.org/podcast survey. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Late last week, the GM of a minor league baseball team in Iowa accused Major League Baseball of using the COVID-19 pandemic to get rid of more than 40 minor league teams.
They're a $13 billion industry, and they're picking on, you know, some of these smaller minor league clubs.
That's Ted Tornow, GM of the Clinton Lumber Kings, speaking with the Des Moines Register.
Just to arbitrarily wipe us off the face and really... upend the structure of minor league baseball, it makes no sense at all.
Here to help us make sense of what's going on is J.J. Cooper, who's been covering this for Baseball America. Hi, J.J.
Hi, Karen.
To really understand this story, I want to take you back, all the way back to 1963, when the first professional baseball agreement, or PBA, was put into place. So what did the PBA do?
In the late 50s, early 60s, there really was a legitimate question about whether minor league baseball was sustainable, which was a kind of shocking development at the time, because you go back right after World War II, pretty much if you were in a town in the U.S., you probably had a minor league team. There were over 400 teams, millions, 40 million plus fans going to games. And then you turn around 10 years later, TV had really kind of taken away that audience. Major League Baseball stepped in and said, we're going to support you so that you can have a minimum number of teams because we need the teams to develop these players.
Under that system, minor league players are actually paid by the major league teams that hold their contracts, right?
Absolutely. The players themselves, coaching staffs as well, but when it comes to putting on the games, when it comes to the travel, when it comes to all those things, that's the responsibility of the minor league team, the minor league owner.
So I don't want to suggest that everything moved along swimmingly from 1963 till now. In fact, the entire system almost fell apart in 1990. So tell me about that.
What happened is minor league baseball started to become actually a viable business. Bull Durham, the movie, comes out, which actually I think really did play a big part in kind of romanticizing the appeal of going to a minor league park.
Today!
Whoa, too bad, Butch. Too bad.
In 1990, Major League Baseball owners looked at minor league baseball and said, wait a second, why are we footing so much of the bill if they're having success? And the two sides almost walked away from each other. It got bad enough there. Every December, there's a winter meetings where everyone in baseball professional level gets together. And that year, they actually went to their separate cities. They couldn't even get together. Cooler heads prevailed and a deal was reached. And that kind of led to, I would say, almost 30 years of detente. It really hasn't been a contentious argument until we get to here in 2020.
All right, so let's set the scene for what happened last fall. On the one hand, minor league teams had a pretty good 2019 season. Attendance was up, spirits were high, right?
Yes, absolutely.
On the other hand, a federal appeals court allowed a class action lawsuit that alleges that minor league players are being paid less than minimum wage. And this could cost Major League Baseball quite a lot of money, right?
Oh, absolutely. And there's, in essence, a minor league player right now has to show up in February or early March. They may only get paid from June to September, even though that they're required to be there from February to maybe October. Major League Baseball is facing some potential for court liability there. And Major League Baseball has already come out and said for next year that they are raising salaries for minor league players. They have said one of the reasons that they want to cut the number of teams is the idea that that would allow them to pay those remaining players more than they do under the current system.
And that leads to the proposal MLB made in October. In a nutshell, what would that proposal do?
Major League Baseball's proposal was, we're going to go from 160 to 120. That means that every major league team would have four ticket-buying clubs low A, high A, double A, triple A. As you might imagine, the reception from minor league baseball upon hearing the proposal to cut 1/4 of their membership was, we are strongly, vehemently, and utterly opposed to such a plan.
So both sides met at these winter meetings to talk about this. Describe that scene for me.
I've been going to winter meetings for close to 20 years, and I would describe it as probably the frostiest winter meetings that I've ever been a part of. And to be honest, at the winter meetings, there wasn't a whole lot of progress made. What minor league baseball realized after that was the best hope of winning this negotiation was to win the battle of public opinion and win the battle of political pressure. And so there was a pretty intensive lobbying campaign afterward where you saw U.S. representatives from all around the country, mayors, governors, all kind of trying to turn up the temperature, put pressure on Major League Baseball to back away from this 120 plan. Then everything changed.
Right, right. So then, of course, the coronavirus forced teams to send players home from spring training. Opening day was postponed. And even if Major League Baseball returns without fans in the stands, minor league teams likely won't. So what does that leave these minor league clubs for revenue?
Almost nothing. They had had a normal offseason. They had staffed up to be ready for what they thought was going to be a very successful season. They had, you know, bought a lot of their merchandise and all that they're going to sell this year. And then right before the season starts, where in the off season, you don't make almost anything. I mean, the minor league teams make their money when people walk through the gates. They bought a ticket. They're going to buy a hat. They're going to buy a beer. They're going to buy a hot dog. All of that money just was turned off right before it started.
So how did that change this conversation?
It dramatically upended it, I would say. We went from having public pressure and political pressure being MILB's strongest weapon in this negotiation. And on both ends, the air almost immediately went out of the balloon. I mean, there are bigger things going on in the country right now, obviously, not to diminish this, but there just are. And on top of that, minor league baseball is a sales-driven business. Well, not having that schedule, not having that certainty when someone says to you, are you really going to be here next year? That adds more difficulty and really adds more impetus on the minor league side to get to a deal where there is no similar time pressure for Major League Baseball.
And now it looks like MLB is going to get what it wants.
Right. I mean, there is no deal yet, but there seems to now be much more of an acceptance on the minor league side that it is going to be 120 full season affiliated clubs. But MLB is publicly professing to ensure that these cities that currently have affiliate baseball have baseball, whether it's going to be an independent professional league or whether it's a Summerwood Bat League where college players, and that's where they come to play in the summer. So baseball can survive. If you have a stadium and you have an operator who knows what they're doing, a lot of these cities, baseball will survive. I don't want to discount, though, you are going to lose something because Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is now playing for Toronto, but it wasn't that many years ago that he was playing in the Appalachian League. And so anywhere around that league of really small towns, you had the chance to see a guy who's going to be one of the biggest stars in baseball. That part's going to be taken away. And there is something that I romanticize about that because it's formative of my baseball fandom.
So when Ted Tornau, GM of the Clinton Lumber Kings, tells the Des Moines Register that MLB is using the COVID-19 crisis to force these changes through, is he right? Is he overstating it?
The way I've had it put to me is if you were trying to design a way to ensure that this plan went through, you couldn't do something much more effective than what the coronavirus has done. Before this happened, we're talking last October, it may be something like, no, I'm going to fight to the last degree to save my team being affiliate baseball. Well, if that owner gets to June of this year and they're looking at their balance sheet and there's a plan in this where they continue to have baseball going forward in an economically sustainable way, and potentially there's compensation, which may help, to be honest, pay some of the sponsors and all that you owe money right now. That may sound a whole lot different now because we've gone through an almost unimaginable circumstance than it did if we were talking last October.
J.J. Cooper is the executive editor of Baseball America. J.J., thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you for the time.
J.J. Cooper is right. Sometimes baseball can survive, even thrive, without a major league affiliation. But it isn't always easy. With a story that first aired in August of 2018, here's reporter Matthew Stock.
Jesse and Emily Cole were at a friend's wedding in New Jersey when the COO of their business called with bad news.
Jesse, we just overdrafted our account. We're completely out of money.
For the first time, really, we had completely failed. I mean, how do you run out of money and not have a backup plan?
A few months earlier, Jesse and Emily had bought a collegiate summer league baseball team in Savannah, Georgia. They had already taken on millions of dollars in debt, and opening day was still months away. On the drive home from New Jersey to North Carolina, Jesse and Emily talked about what they could do to keep their new team afloat. And Emily came up with a plan.
She turned to me, she said, "We have no other options. We have to sell our house."
It was in the back of our minds the whole drive, but it took me saying it for us both to accept that that was really our only option left. We were not ready to give up on this.
This was not Jesse's first experience with a failing baseball team. In 2008, as a 23-year-old bachelor, he was hired as the general manager of the Gastonia Grizzlies.
I showed up that first day. The team was only averaging a couple hundred fans a game. I found out that the team had lost over $100,000 the previous year, and I found out that there was $268 in the bank account.
Right away, Jesse started calling local businesses to drum up sponsorships. Most weren't interested, and some had never even heard of the Grizzlies.
I was like, what have I got myself into? I mean, the team had been there, but nobody cared.
So Jesse went to the team owner with a new idea.
Ken, we can no longer be a baseball team. We need to be a circus, and maybe a baseball game will break out. And luckily, he didn't fire me, and he said we got nothing to lose.
Jesse called a group of his college friends, and they started brainstorming ideas to draw fans to Grizzlies games. Things were about to get crazy in Gastonia.
You know, we came up with Flatulence Fun Night, where we actually gave away whoopee cushions at the gate, and we had a farting contest on the field, a bean burrito eating contest. Salute to Underwear Night. If anybody wore their underwear on the outside of their pants and came in, they got a free ticket. George Bush was the president, and his term was over. So what do? We offered him an internship.
Jesse also brought the players into the fun. They started handing out programs before warmups and doing choreographed dances in between innings.
It started getting a lot of buzz, and that's when the attendance started skyrocketing. It really became bigger than we even imagined.
People started hearing about Jesse and the Grizzlies. Among them was a young woman named Emily McDonald.
My boss at the time heard Jesse speak at a conference, and she actually left the room and called me and said, "I met the guy that you're going to marry."
Emily was working for a minor league baseball team in Augusta, Georgia. Like Jesse, she also believed that fan-centric entertainment was the secret to success in baseball. The two started exchanging emails, and sure enough,
over time, just kind of got to know each other and fell in love, and then I ended up moving to Gastonia and working for the team with him. I will always remember the first time I walked into that Gastonia ballpark. Jesse was teaching the players the Thriller dance on the field. In a tuxedo, by the way, he was in a black tuxedo. We were having a blast from the first moment that I stepped foot in that stadium.
And just a few months later, Jesse stopped a Grizzlies game between innings, brought the entire staff out onto the field, and dropped to a knee in front of Emily.
I had the ring inside a baseball, which I carved open, and I proposed to her.
Emily said yes, which cued a 30-minute fireworks display before play could resume. To continue the celebration, the couple planned a weekend trip to Savannah, Georgia. Neither of them had been before. And of course, one of their first stops was a minor league game at Grayson Stadium.
We walked into this ballpark and we fell in love.
Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Hank Aaron all played there.
We could feel the history and the character coming out of it. This beautiful brick, huge archways. I mean, it was gorgeous.
But when Jesse and Emily looked around the grandstands, they realized the place was almost completely empty.
It was a beautiful ballpark on a beautiful night, and the whole atmosphere was just sad.
Ever the optimists, the couple marveled at Grayson Stadium's potential.
What an awesome opportunity if this place ever was available to bring life back to this ballpark.
And it didn't take long for Savannah's minor league team to offer that opportunity.
Within the next year, we heard that they couldn't draw fans, they couldn't have success in Savannah, they needed a new stadium, and the city wouldn't build them a new stadium, and they were leaving.
Jesse and Emily had bought a majority share of the Gastonia Grizzlies earlier that year, and they had just put the finishing touches on their dream house.
We built a fire pit, a bar, we had a hot tub back there. It was the hangout place.
But Grayson Stadium was up for grabs, and the newlyweds couldn't resist. In 2016, they bought their second franchise in the Coastal Plain League and began building a new team in Savannah.
We started calling everyone in this community. We're here. We're going to do baseball right. We're going to make it fun. We're going to have tons of entertainment. And what happened? Crickets. I mean, nothing. No one believed us.
Jesse says the team sold just one season ticket in its first 2 months. They were hardly bringing in any money. So after that phone call,
we're completely out of money.
Our only option left.
We have to sell our house.
Jesse and Emily sold their dream house and moved to Savannah. From there, they put every penny they had into the team, even if it meant that their new living arrangements were a significant step down.
I actually went and looked at this duplex first, and it was horrible. I mean, disgusting.
The nastiest, most decrepit, worst fixer-upper place.
I opened the door and take him in, and he just shook his head no and ran back out. But after talking it through and realizing that this is truly all we could afford, we decided to buy it.
We slept with our socks on because the floor was so disgusting.
We had to lift one leg up and over the toilet in order to sit down because your knees were touching the wall.
One night, my wife woke up screaming, and there was a cockroach on my face. We didn't want to tell people closest to us how much we were suffering and struggling. We hadn't even named the team.
Jesse and Emily believed that a great team name could turn things around. They announced a naming competition in the local newspaper for fans to submit suggestions. Jesse and Emily wanted something unique. No generic animal names or weather phenomena. Something for Savannah to unite behind. Over 1,000 people wrote in, but one submission stood out. The Savannah Bananas. The ideas came quickly.
This could be great. We could have a mascot named Split. We could have a senior citizen dance team called the Banana Nanas. We could have a promotion where we throw bananas from the top deck and people catch it in their pants, and it's called Banana in the Pants. Our slogan could be Go Bananas. We came up with all the ideas and said we have to do it.
On February 25th, 2016, Jesse and Emily announced the new team name. Within minutes, the Savannah Bananas were number one trending on Twitter, and merchandise orders were flooding in from all over the country. But the Savannah community had a different response.
We got crucified. They were saying the owners should be thrown out of town. You guys are an embarrassment to this city. You'll never sell a ticket. Please leave our town. Who are you guys? Who do you think you are?
For the Bananas, however, all press was good press. The team sold out its opening night game.
I think a lot of it was people just saying, let me go check out these crazy people. They're probably going to fail. This is probably going to be a joke. But regardless, they bought the tickets and they showed up.
Over 4,000 fans arrived at Grayson Stadium for the Bananas' June 2nd season opener. For once, everything was going to plan. Until the rain came.
That's just what happens in the baseball world. Sometimes the gods are not in your favor.
A Savannah downpour that you would never, it was unbelievable.
The Bananas waited almost 3 hours to begin play. But even after the delay, their sellout crowd was still in their seats.
There was 4,000 people still there, waiting to watch the Savannah Bananas.
It was clear from the game itself that people weren't staying to see quality baseball.
I think we made 6 errors. We were letting up runs left and right.
They stayed for the show.
We have a breakdancing first base coach, a 30-piece pep band playing either Final Countdown or Rocky or Uptown Funk. It's a nonstop entertainment experience. Our scripts take hours to produce because every night it's a different script.
The Bananas sold out 18 games in 2016, their inaugural season.
So many operators, they focus first on how do they make the best team. Well, we've realized it's the exact opposite. You focus on the environment, the fans, and then the baseball takes care of itself.
That story came from reporter Matthew Stock. It first aired in August of 2018. Since Matthew spoke with Jesse and Emily Cole, the Savannah Bananas have extended their sellout streak to 88 games. Earlier this week, the Coastal Plain League announced their plan to begin the 2020 season on July 1st. In 1986, Jennifer Say won the USA Gymnastics National Championship.
And I remember it very distinctly. That was the real first time I ever was like, maybe this is enough.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Music. Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Earlier this week, USA Gymnastics suspended coach Maggie Haney for 8 years for the verbal and emotional abuse of her athletes, including Olympic gold medalist Lori Hernandez. The crimes of Larry Nassar, who was sentenced to 175 years in prison for sexually abusing gymnasts in his care, made headlines. But verbal and emotional abuse has been alleged in the sport since long before Nassar's crimes came to light. Olivia Christian has one such story.
In 1976, Happy Days was the most popular show on television. Silly love songs by Paul McCartney and Wings topped the Billboard charts. And that summer in Montreal, the world, including a six-year-old Jennifer Say, was introduced to Romanian gymnast Nadia Comăneci, the first ever to score a perfect 10 in the Olympics.
And 10 has gone on the board. That's perfection. And that is Olympic history for Nadia Comăneci.
You know, the fact that she was only 14 and she looked like a little girl, that was really... that had an impact, I think, not just on me, but a lot of little girls across the country.
That's Jennifer. At the time, Jennifer was living in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, taking classes at Wilmore Gymnastics. After seeing Nadia, she begged her parents to let her go as often as possible. Jennifer soon joined their team and competed on weekends.
You know, back then, these were real competitions. Like, it wasn't like that everyone gets a trophy. Like, if you weren't good enough, there was no trophy. So it was pretty cutthroat. And I loved everything about it. I loved how it felt. I loved being scared. I loved learning new things. I loved my teammates. And I just kept wanting to go more and more, and I just kept sort of doing better.
Jennifer went to the gym 3 or 4 times a week for 3 and 4 hour practices. After 2 years, she decided she wanted to compete for a shot at making the U.S. national team.
And I said to my parents, I came home and I was like, I can't do that from this gym. I need to go to another gym. At 9, I was demanding to go to another better gym that had trained elite athletes. And so we made the decision to go to another gym in New Jersey, a little further down the road.
Her stay-at-home mom drove her to and from practices.
And I made my first national team at 10.
This rigorous training was fun for Jennifer. She enjoyed the competition, and she loved her coach.
She was an incredible human being, and I think she's everything a coach should be. You know, she would have considered herself, she's since passed away, an educator first and foremost, someone who sort of used sport to raise confident young girls. And in fact, I remember a moment she asked me one summer, you know, we trained longer in the summer, and she said, is there anything you want to do today? And in her mind, she was thinking of giving me the day off so I could go do something fun with my friends. And I was like, I want to do an extra round of beam training because I'm working on this skill. And she thought that was so funny. But she was always encouraging us to be sort of whole people. But that wasn't what I wanted at the time. I wanted to be in the top 6 in the country. And so at 13, I had a very serious conversation with my parents, and we started to assess the different options.
There was this date looming ahead for Jennifer, her 15th birthday. 15 is the age gymnasts can move up and compete at senior events like the World Championships and the Olympics. She knew she had to find a gym that could get her there. After visiting 3 top gyms across the country, Jennifer decided on Allentown, Pennsylvania. From the moment she walked in, Jennifer noticed things at this gym were different.
We were weighed twice a day. We were berated for what we ate and what we looked like. You know, I remember clearly after a 6-hour practice, my mom brought me a bagel and a coach snatched it from my hands. Like, you're not going to eat that, are you?
At first, Jennifer and her family drove the 2 hours back and forth every day. Then at 14, she moved out of her home to live with a coach in Allentown. There, the insults and shaming continued.
It was sort of control through fear tactics. And I was okay with it. I wasn't happy, and I quickly became probably depressed. But I was holding so fast to this idea that I could achieve this thing, and my whole worldview was kind of wrapped around that. And I thought, this is just the price that you pay.
Jennifer says she and the other gymnasts didn't talk to each other about what they were experiencing.
we sort of watch it on TV at the Olympics and think it's a team sport, but it's not. It's an individual sport, and you're vying for an individual spot, and you're vying for your coach's favor, and you're vying for the judge, you know. And I think we were just all too afraid to show any weakness.
Struggling to maintain her weight, Jennifer's injuries began piling up. Days before team trials for the 1985 World Championships, she broke two fingers and got two black eyes after landing on her head on the balance beam. Jennifer was rushed to the emergency room.
The doctor was told not to give me stitches because that would make me not look right for the meet because there's an aesthetic component.
Despite those injuries, and while wearing layers of tape and makeup, she performed well. She was second in the country, qualifying her for the World Championships. They took place just weeks later in Montreal. There, Jennifer gave what she describes as solid performances in 7 of the 8 events.
And it was my last event of the competition. It was bars. And I had a devastating fall.
Oh, and there's a nasty tumble, and she looks badly hurt.
Trainers rushed to Jennifer's side. They quickly got her onto a stretcher and into an ambulance where her dad rode with her to the hospital.
I just remember being so just desperate, like, this was it. This is over. I'm just starting to get to the level that I thought I could maybe get to, and now my career is done, and I don't know how to do anything else.
Jennifer underwent surgery. When she woke up, she learned that she had broken her right femur, an injury that is not as difficult to come back from as a knee or some other joint injury. Jennifer and her team were relieved by this news. Talk quickly turned to how to get her back in competition shape.
You know, I started with a traditional plaster, then I went to something lighter, and then that doctor I described gave me something with a hinge so that I could kind of move it so there'd be less atrophy. I was in the gym every day. I trained bars, which is crazy, with a spot. I just kept training, and I didn't have the cast long enough. It was well under, I think, the whatever the recommended time frame is, probably 12 to 15 weeks. I think I got it off in maybe 8 or 9 weeks.
For the next 8 months, Jennifer just kept going, limping along, favoring her other leg, training for her next big competition, the U.S. Nationals.
The courage of Jennifer Say led her on to the title as women's all-around champion of the USA. But the pain was a heavy price. All right, have you come down from the victory yet? How are you feeling about that all-around championship?
I definitely haven't come down yet. I'm very excited. It's just, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me.
You were marvelous, but you did pay a price for it. I understand that your ankles are pretty sore. Can you tell me about that?
Well, my left ankle has been bothering me. Before I came into this competition, it sprained pretty badly, and it hurt a lot yesterday, but it's over.
Jennifer had just won the 1986 national title, but the years of struggles were finally catching up to her. The Olympics were 2 years away.
I was sitting there thinking, you know, with my ankle in a bucket of ice, this is probably as good as it's going to get. And I remember it very distinctly. That was the real first time I ever was like, maybe this is enough.
She remembers asking herself, should I stop right now? But no adult, no coach, no parent posed that question to her.
Well, who stops when they just won a national championship?
Jennifer deferred going to Stanford by a year to train for the 87 USA Championships. Only her drive was no longer there. After the competition, Jennifer knew she was done. But her parents needed convincing.
And I believe, to some extent, that they didn't understand the depths of my depression and didn't understand that it was physically and emotionally impossible for me to continue. I mean, I thought about killing myself. When I drove my car, I thought constantly about driving over the median into oncoming traffic. I didn't share this with them, so I don't think they understood it.
After a series of difficult conversations with her family, Jennifer left gymnastics. When she got to Stanford in 1988, she was exhausted. Surrounded by smart, world-class athletes who were just hitting their prime, Jennifer felt like she was going into retirement, happy to sleep and eat, and to not have to rehab any injuries. After Stanford, Jennifer started working for Levi Strauss. She rose through the company, ultimately becoming the CMO of global brands.
But I suffered, you know. I accepted treatment that I shouldn't have accepted from friends and from romantic partners and from bosses. Like I felt like that's what I was worthy of. You know, I'd been treated that way for many years in the gym. And so I eventually went into therapy and came to understand a lot of this.
Jennifer decided to write her story.
I sat down to write it not really thinking that I would ever get published, but just to sort of make peace and kind of understand it myself, I guess. And I mean, at this point, I was nearly 40 and still sort of wrestling with it. But then I wrote it in almost like a fever state. I think in 3 months or 2 months, I wrote a draft. And I sent it to a friend who was a novelist. And she said, it's a book. This is a book.
Chalked Up, My Life in Elite Gymnastics was published in 2008. Within months, Jennifer's story and the details of the horror she faced was out there for the world to read. And the response from the gymnastics community was quick.
It was harrowing and absolutely vicious. And preyed on all my sort of biggest fears. And it's the tactic, the strategy of the community, right? Like, there can't be any validity here. You are a loser. You were terrible. You are a failed ex-gymnast who never accomplished anything, and now you're just taking it out on the sport.
Jennifer heard it from gymnasts, coaches, and gym owners.
It was hard. It was really hurtful. And it was, despite being 40, despite being a mom, despite having nothing to do with the community, it is still your community. It's what I grew up in, you know?
Readings in Pennsylvania, where she had spent years training, had to be canceled because of threats. The publisher feared people would be screaming and yelling at her. But
I got hundreds, if not thousands, of letters from people that said, thank you. I felt this way too, and now I feel less ashamed or less alone or less whatever.
And then,
in August of 2016, a team of reporters from the Indianapolis Star published accounts from gymnasts who accused Nassar of sexually abusing them during supposed medical procedures.
A group of senators are calling for a congressional investigation of the U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Gymnastics.
For years, Larry Nassar was responsible for the care of most of the top gymnasts in the United States. In a Michigan courtroom, he pleaded guilty to charges of criminal sexual misconduct.
As athletes and fans ask publicly how the crimes of Larry Nassar could have been allowed to go on for so long, Jennifer became what she calls a voice of history of the sport. She went to D.C. and met with Senator Dianne Feinstein on the Safe Sport Authorization Act. Passed in 2018, this law requires governing bodies and amateur sports organizations to report sexual abuse allegations to local or federal authorities. While Jennifer is encouraged that allegations of sexual abuse are being believed and prosecuted, that they've led to resignations and firings, she still feels there is more work to be done in the sport with regard to what she sees as other types of abuse.
I don't believe really anything, and certainly not enough, I don't believe has changed. I mean, my coaches are still coaching, and they're incredibly abusive, and I don't think they've changed. If you're starving and you're told you're fat, if you're in pain and you're told you're lazy, you don't believe your own perception of the world. Imagine how disorienting that is for a child.
If you had a message that you could give to young women who are considering becoming part of the gymnastics community in USA Gymnastics right now, what would you tell them?
Well, I think I would tell any young girl, trust your own take on things. Don't accept poor treatment. I would tell their parents to pay attention and look out for them. I would say do it as long as it's fun. But if you love it and you're having fun, then do it. If you're not, say something, speak up, stand up for yourself, use your voice.
That story came from reporter Olivia Christian. What happens when a sports columnist becomes his children's school teacher? Chaos.
I think that if we get to, 65% of the assigned material, I feel good about that. You know, look, in sports, if you're winning 60% of your games, you're a playoff contender.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread,
a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, with no sports to announce, broadcasters have gotten creative.
Will you join me live for what I've been told is the Tooting Dogging Final, and these two, Vanilla and Chocolate, doing really well here. Vanilla just over the hillock in the distance, Chocolate in hot pursuit. There's been some lovely footwork, and there it is again from Vanilla. That's excellent. The Spaniel now out in front, and that's confused the hell out of it.
But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The NCAA Board of Governors has approved a plan to allow athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness. I know we've been talking about how the NCAA was being forced into making this move for months, maybe even years, but I still can't quite believe it actually happened.
Yeah, this is bowing extraordinarily slowly to the inevitable. And it's only the first of many developments on this front. Because now you are admitting that what you're doing is employing professional athletes. You're just letting somebody else pay them.
Right. Well, according to some experts, top athletes could make more than $1 million a year from sponsorship opportunities while playing at the college level. In the past, the NCAA has argued that this would be a slippery slope to a full dismantling of the amateur model. It sounds like you think that's where we're headed.
Oh, I think there's no question that's where we're headed, because the more the amateur model looks ridiculous, the less tenable it is. And now with this rule, it looks completely ridiculous.
In what might be what is thus far my favorite proposal to get sports going again, the NBA is reportedly considering playing out the remainder of its season at Disney World. Do you think Mickey would be there?
Well, I mean, it's a complete branding opportunity for ESPN,
yeah,
and for Disney. Who have, you know, the rights to NBA games. I have one question, though. After the final game, when they go up to the MVP and ask him what he's going to do next, what's he going to say?
He's already,
you know,
there.
I'm going to Six Flags? He's already at Disney World.
Charlie, as you know, with most sports schedules on hold, ESPN moved up the broadcast of its 10-part documentary on Michael Jordan. After the first four episodes, The Last Dance is currently the number one documentary in the world, even drawing more viewers than The Tiger King. And it's the highest-rated programming on ESPN since 2004. Are you surprised by this?
No, people are sports hungry. They're television sports hungry. And Michael Jordan remains a compelling figure, although I'm not very compelled by him. I can understand why other people are. And, you know, this was hyped as an inside look. And while it's not entirely that, it scratches the itch people have for some kind of sports on television.
This thing is going to stretch on until May 17th. Do you think the interest will hold?
Yes, I do. Because I think the quarantine will certainly stretch on until then. Although it depends, I guess, if the NBA is, you know, down there playing in Disney World, who knows?
It's maybe not surprising that the virtual 2020 NFL draft set viewership records. 55 million people watched over the three-day event. But I'd like to talk about the bigger surprise of the event, Patriots coach Bill Belichick's dog, Nike. He is a very good dog, don't you think?
I thought he was a wonderful dog, and he drafted pretty well, to be honest with you. I think, you know, he probably doesn't comment much to the press, I don't think. That would be the one thing. In fact, I believe Bill Belichick's dog has said about as much to the press as most of his assistant coaches have down through the years.
You and I have talked about the oddness of sports in empty stadiums, Charlie. Well, a German pro soccer club has come up with a solution to that problem. For about $20, you can upload a picture of yourself that will be made into a life-size cardboard cutout and placed in the stands if and when games resume. That'll solve the problem, right?
Hey, listen, it's all fun and games until the cardboard cutouts start getting drunk and beating each other up. Who would pay $20 for their likeness in a stadium? Even by international soccer standards, this is a great scam.
Well, it's cheaper than actually going to a game, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, but I mean, what do you gain from it? And what if it rains? You know, when it rains, you're gonna like turn to pulp.
And finally, Charlie, the lack of live sporting events has led to the unearthing of a number of previously neglected sports stories. I'd like to draw your attention to one such story, the list of fictional American baseball player names created for a 1994 Japanese video game. Who are you rooting for? Glenn Allen Mixon or Mike Cernandez?
Neither one. I am a big Bobson Dugnut fan.
Go Bobson.
It's funny to read these because you can figure out what players they're talking about.
Yeah.
Ray McSriff is definitely Fred McGriff. Willie Dustis is probably David Justice. Steve McDykel may be Steve McMichael, but he was a football player. So I'm unclear on some of these.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor for the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
We've had some incredible guests on the show recently. U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe, future Basketball Hall of Famer Sue Bird, comedian Gary Goldman.
Karen, it was a pleasure, and your voice is very soothing.
Check out those conversations or listen to them again by subscribing to the Only a Game podcast, wherever you're getting your podcasts these days. And while you're there, please leave us a review. True story. I once apologized to the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay for being out of touch, explaining that I'd been under deadline for my year-long investigation into girls' lacrosse helmets. He responded about 10 hours later, apologizing for the delay and explaining he'd spent the day with the Jonas Brothers.
We go together, better than birds of a feather, you and me.
Look, I'm not trying to suggest that every day as a national sports columnist is glamorous and exciting. I'm just saying that when someone brings up the atmosphere at last summer's Women's World Cup, Jason's the guy who says, I was there. Jason Gay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, man, you know, you make me yearn for days gone by, you know, just hanging around with the Jonas Brothers, drinking non-alcoholic smoothies, you know, riding the wheels with the Jonas Brothers, Karen. My life was just a series of glamorous events. I'm a sucker
for you. So I do imagine that before the COVID-19 pandemic, your average workday started with, I don't know, maybe kicking your feet up on your desk, calling your good buddy Roger Federer, chatting about the best macaron shop near Roland Garros. Have I got that about right?
You know, other than the fact that Roger would be sitting there right with me and we'd be having that debate in person, that's exactly, exactly what my life was like. As if you had a surveillance camera there.
All right. So how do your days start now?
Listen, everybody's life has been upended and nobody wants to hear from some sort of pampered sports writer about their struggles during this, you know, serious situation. But the truth of the matter is that there's never been more happening.
Yeah.
Everything is impacted. And the decisions that are being made now are going to have incredible repercussions for not just the coming year, but perhaps for the future of sports overall. I think the way that we played games and certainly the way that we attended games is going to change radically in the short term and perhaps significantly over the long term. You know, when this started to unfold, a lot of my friends sort of looked at me like I, you know, owned a Betamax supply store and said, well, man, I don't know what you're going to do, but there's a lot going on.
So in the meantime, you've kind of taken on a second job, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the truth of the matter is that sports writing for me is no longer a day job. It is something that happens in the funny hours, you know, in the darkness of the morning with the little birdies chirping or late at night after my family's gone to bed. I am a school teacher, Karen, and this will not shock you to learn that I am a lousy school teacher. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old at home, and you know, that might seem like not exactly heavy academic material, but Karen, it's been decades since I've done phonics. My poor children are saddled with dear old dummy dad, who barely knows his way around an iPad, trying to get them through this virtual school experience.
I mean, you have been surrounded by teachers your entire life.
Yeah.
Both of your parents were teachers, your wife is a teacher. I mean, you must have picked up some tips over those decades.
You know, my parents' main instruction about teaching when I was a child was don't become a teacher. And the fact of the matter is that I think teachers are miracles. They are, I think a lot of us have learned this over these past, 4 to 6 weeks. They're miracles in terms of just the ability to not just teach, but to comfort, console, to build community. I mean, I see it up close and personal with my wife in terms of, you know, the amount of effort that goes into making that school day happen. That's happening at night. That's happening on weekends. That's happening in the early mornings. This notion that somehow they're just like transferring the schoolhouse over to the iPad and that is just absurd. I don't think teachers have ever worked harder. So in terms of, did I pick up anything along the way from my parents? I mean, I think they were just better people than I was, Karen. So that's why I became a sports writer.
All right. So as a substitute teacher, how do you define a successful school day at this point?
No violence, I think, is the first thing. I think that if we get to, let's say, a solid, 65% of the assigned material, I feel good about that. You know, look, in sports, if you're winning 60% of your games, you're a playoff contender. So I'm taking the same approach.
Well, have you thought about adding any extra like PE units? I mean, that's a subject matter should be knowledgeable about.
Yes. Well, listen, what I do is I wake up in the morning and say, oh, today's PE, you need to run around the building 750 times and just get me in a couple hours. You know, I know people like to goof about like what gym class requirements are and so on, but to be serious here for a minute, when we consider the mental component of this and the physical mental connection, that's as important an assignment as there possibly is.
And just to stay serious for just a minute, because we've been joking a lot about how your kids are stuck with you as a teacher, but in reality, they've got it pretty good.
You know, and that's an important, important point, perhaps the most important point to make in this is the fortune that we have to be with a school that is giving, students the tools and to have the technological access, because far, far too many children, Karen, are not given the kinds of support systems. And in many ways, it's sort of mirroring the structure and the imbalances that were already there, but we're seeing it in sharper relief. This is a serious problem, and I know many, many cities and school districts are grappling with it, including my home city of New York.
What have you learned from all of this?
I have learned that I would probably have to repeat first grade. I have learned wonderful things about my children. I mean, you can go to all of the parent-teacher conferences in the world, but there's no substitute for kind of riding shotgun.
Are there any messages you'd like me to pass on to your kids' teachers?
We're not cheating. You know, I won't lie. There have been a few moments where I've looked at that iPad and, said to myself, I know the answer to 10 minus 5. But, I just figure, one day you're cheating on your kids' virtual homework. The next day you're hiring a landscape architect to build their volcano in fourth grade. And then a bunch of years later, you're photoshopping a kid's head on top of a rower's body and trying to sneak them into college, getting raided by the FBI and winding up in the slammer. So I'm not going there, Karen. So if you can relay, we are sticking to the rules. I am a man of integrity, Karen.
Thanks, Jason. Or maybe I should say thank you, Mr. Gay.
Oh, please call me Jason. This is a very informal school. In fact, lunch is coming up. And today, for the 18th day in a row, we're doing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, Karen.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We'll have a link to his piece, I Teach School Now, It Isn't Going Well, at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.